Well, it's a pleasure to be here with all of you, and this is certainly a subject that I've enjoyed taking time to study and have been looking at for the last couple of years, trying to get a better understanding of some of the issues in Revelation 12, actually through 16. And for the presentation today, I'm going to be focusing on actually chapters 12 and 13, dealing specifically with the topic of Sabbath in those two chapters. And the one thing I'd like to note to begin with, this was my original title, and I'll show you the changed title that they put on it in just a moment, but the idea that I had behind it in using this title to begin with, Sabbath sacredness, you notice that the word Sabbath is in quotation marks, meaning the idea behind it is that in chapter 13, it's not actually the true Sabbath that is conveyed or taught there, as we'll see through this presentation, and that's why the subtitle is The Broken Law and Violated Covenant Through a False Sabbath. The title given to the actual presentation that you got in the bulletin is The Sabbath in Revelation 13. And just to give you a thematic overview of the direction that we're going, these are the five main points. Number one being creation of man and the Sabbath, the Exodus and Mount Sinai apostasy, Elijah and the Mount Carmel showdown, the golden image and the fiery furnace, and then each of those four themes that contribute in point number five to the understanding of the symbolism in Revelation 12 and 13. Now, the thing that I'll mention about the first four points, as we go through the presentation, you'll see that some of these are not specifically stated. They're actually nuances. There's symbolism that makes reference to these events of the Old Testament that are couched in the chapters of Revelation 12 and 13. Section 1, dealing with the creation of man and the Sabbath. Based on previous Adventist scholarship that identifies a counterfeit Trinity in Revelation 13, we know that just as there's God the Father, Jesus the Son, and the Holy Spirit, that in Revelation chapter 13, there's the dragon, the beast, and the second beast, or as the false prophet. Both of those, in both of those paradigms, they contribute to, in the true sense, man being made in the image of the Godhead. And point number four in Revelation chapter 13, the image being made to the beast. The point that I'd like to mention about this that is significant is that we find the Godhead contributing in the creation of man. And in Revelation chapter 13, it is those three powers uniting their forces together that lead to the image to the beast and eventually to the mark of the beast being formed. In Revelation chapter 13, we also find the first three commandments of the Ten Commandments that are made reference to, but from the perspective of those commandments being violated or broken. You'll see that on the left-hand side of the screen, there's the first commandment and the second commandment that are mentioned, and on your right-hand side of the screen, both of those commandments are actually violated or broken in Revelation chapter 13, verse 4. It says they worshiped the dragon. Revelation 13, verse 15, they ended up making an image to the beast. Both of those actions are violation of the first and the second commandments. The third commandment about not taking the name of the Lord thy God in vain in Revelation chapter 13, verse 5, the activity of the beast is to blaspheme the name of God. Now, if you'll notice there, I've put in Revelation 13 a question mark under the Sabbath, under a tag, because if we study Revelation chapter 13 in its entirety, we don't find a single reference to the word Sabbath. However, when we take time to study the first four commandments of the Ten Commandments, we recognize that those are dealing with man's worship of God. So if the first three commandments are being violated in Revelation chapter 13, the logical conclusion is that somewhere in that picture there needs to be a reference or somehow the Sabbath is being violated. That's the logical conclusion that one would come to. So with that question in mind, we pursue our study just a little bit further, and we take time to notice that in Revelation 12, when it makes reference to the woman, it is reminiscent, symbols that could be alluded to Eve in the Garden of Eden. In fact, if you take time to study Catholic scholars, they will argue that point quite ardently, that it's actually referring to Eve and not referring to the church. You'll notice also that the second beast in Revelation 13, verse 14, he had power to give life, and the Greek is actually pneumos, breath, unto the image of the beast, and therefore it would lead to the conclusion of a false Sabbath that is made for man. That's based on the pattern that we find down here at the bottom of the creation of man and the Sabbath. God created man on the sixth day. Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, the Bible states that the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. Then, on the seventh day, God created the Sabbath, and according to Mark chapter 2, verses 27 and 28, that the Lord made the Sabbath for man, and not man for the Sabbath. So, coming back to this paradigm, the next point that we would add to it down at the bottom is that just as the true biblical account of regarding the true and the living God, it tells us that the Godhead created man in his own image, and therefore the Sabbath was made for man. Man's response to his Creator is to keep the Sabbath day. Based on that paradigm, but in a counterfeit context in Revelation 13, we find the first three, those three entities performing a counterfeit trinity, leading to the formation of the image to the beast, and therefore it would lead us to understand or conclude that there needs to be a Sabbath, a counterfeit Sabbath, that will be produced for all of humanity to obey or observe. That's section one that we just concluded. Section two now is dealing with symbols and allusions to the Exodus and the Mount Sinai apostasy. In Revelation chapter 12, we find there's prophecy and history. This is a pattern up here that you can see at the top that is very well known to us as Seventh-day Adventists, talking about the actual historical fulfillment of prophecy. And of course, that's something that myself personally, and I believe most all of us as Adventists, would accept that and recognize the validity of the historical fulfillment of prophecy. However, I would also like to suggest that based on this same symbolism, that we can look at a deeper meaning of prophecy and help, that would help us understand the issues involved in the great controversy. And based on Exodus chapters 1 through 20 and Numbers 11 through 14, this is the chronological unfolding of the story of Israel in those chapters. Talking about Israel as a nation, Moses being their deliverer, Egypt, the nation that kept them in bondage, the Passover signifying their deliverance from Egypt and the Exodus, leading down to the flight, their flight from Pharaoh and the Red Sea victory. Eventually, God led them to Mount Sinai, where He formed a covenant with them based on the Ten Commandments. Then they experienced unbelief at the Jordan and experienced wilderness wanderings after that. In Revelation 12, verses 1 through 17, again, this is nuanced symbols. It's not specifically stated as such, but the nuance is there enough to help us recognize that it's referring back to a spiritual exodus for the people of God in the end of time. We have the woman being interpreted as the church, not only Israel that gave birth to the Messiah Jesus, but also as Jesus established the New Testament church. The man-child being Jesus, the dragon being the persecuting power. Interestingly enough, if you go and look in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 28, you'll find that the power of Egypt, Pharaoh of Egypt, is symbolized as a dragon. So there's sufficient symbolism couched within the language of Revelation chapter 12 to help us understand that there is a spiritual exodus that God is speaking about in that chapter. It concludes or continues on. There's symbolism in Revelation 12 talking about the woman that flees to the wilderness. The dragon spews water, much like the parallel incident of the nation of Israel crossing the Red Sea and God giving them victory there. Eventually, this people of God, they're persecuted by the dragon because they keep the commandments of God. In the history of our church, we've experienced the righteousness by faith message of Jones and Wagner back in the 1880s and 90s. And then, of course, there's lessons from Israel's wanderings that you'll find scattered throughout the writings of Ellen White, making application of their failures as well as their successes to the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Now, the theology of the Exodus event is predicated upon five primary factors. The first one, God's fulfillment of His word to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Number two, God's divine intervention to establish Israel as His nation. Number three, God's action to solemnize His covenant with Israel. Number four, God's action to free Israel that they may worship Him on Mount Sinai. And number five, God's purpose of leading Egypt to acknowledge Him as the sovereign over creation. The identification of these theological issues centralized in the Exodus event of the Old Testament aids in the interpretative significance of Revelation 12 through 16. Doing a literal comparison to a spiritual application in Revelation 12, we find that in Revelation 12, heaven is the promised land for spiritual Israel. God intervenes to establish Israel, His remnant church, in the end of time. Point number three, God ratifies the everlasting covenant through Calvary, and it's also based on the aspect of the Ten Commandments. It involves true worship on the seventh day Sabbath, and the dragon in Revelation 12, Satan, he is led to acknowledge Yahweh as the sovereign over creation or the creator. So one way of looking at it is that much of the issues of the Old Testament history, they find themselves played out again in the end of time with spiritual Israel. A summary then of Revelation 12 is that the Exodus motif is a dominant theme. One second here. The Exodus motif is a dominant theme in Revelation 12. By symbols of the Exodus, John depicts the nation of Israel, Christ, and the remnant people of God as the subjects of Satan's attacks throughout history. Specifically, John refers to the Exodus event of ancient Israel to identify the remnant people of God as the spiritual Israel in the end of time. Building upon this identification, God designates spiritual Israel as the recipients of an exalted covenant relationship patterned after the covenant relationship conferred upon ancient Israel at the time of the Exodus. The theological implications of this relationship form the basis of the dragon's attack upon spiritual Israel in Revelation 13. Now, the next event that happened in the history of the nation of Israel, after they were led to Mount Sinai, God established His covenant with them based on the Ten Commandments, we find the very next thing in Exodus chapters 32 through 34 was the Mount Sinai apostasy, where Aaron ended up building the golden calf. And in Revelation 12 and also chapter 13, we've looked at these symbols already. The next thing that logically we would have in mind at the conclusion of Revelation 12 would be an eschatological apostasy involving an image to the beast and the mark of the beast. That's based on the chronological unfolding of the history of the nation of Israel. So as spiritual Israel patterns after the nation of Israel, that's the event to be expected. And just as the Bible brings out in Revelation 13, those are the very issues that are contained within that chapter. Now, looking at this a little bit more in detail, this aspect of Mount Sinai and the apostasy, Section 2a, Idolatry at Mount Sinai. From Exodus 32, verses 1 through 4, I'm just going to read the highlighted portions. What Israel ended up saying, they said, "For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what has become of him. He had gone up into the mountain, worshiping God, and also receiving the Ten Commandments there." Down in verse 4, the Bible tells us that after he had made it a molten calf, they said, "These be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt." Now, interestingly, the point to bear in mind here is that this is right after God had established a covenant with Israel. And then based on that covenant, we find that here they're breaking the covenant and they're denying that the God, Yahweh, was the God who had brought them out of the Exodus. In fact, God Himself said in verses 7 and 8 of Exodus 32, "They have made them a molten calf, and they said, These be thy gods, O Israel, which have brought thee up out of the land of Egypt." So what Israel had ended up doing is they ended up worshiping other gods, violating the covenant, and believing that other gods had delivered them instead of Yahweh. Therefore, the God of the Exodus, taking this a step further, the gods that they were worshiping, the golden calf was a replica of Apis, the bull worshipped by the Egyptians. The sun god, Re, was believed to sit upon it, invisibly seated upon that calf. Heliopolis was the location of the first systematic theology of Egypt. Although Egypt was polytheistic, the theology of Heliopolis soon became a type of national theology of Egypt. This happened roughly around 1500 BC, about 200 to 300 years before the Exodus event. So the theology of Heliopolis was already well established in the nation of Egypt by the time of the Exodus event. So the Israelites were well accustomed and had knowledge and understanding of the sun god Re and the systematic theology involved in his worship. Thus, through the golden calf, Israel was worshiping the sun god Re, among other gods, because they used gods in the plural when they referred to the golden calf, believed to be sitting upon it. Israel stated that these gods had delivered them from Egypt, ergo, or therefore, Israel had broken its covenant with Yahweh. And this is what is brought out by Moses' actions in Exodus 32, verses 15, 16, and 19. The highlighted portion says that Moses cast the tables out of his hands and break them beneath the mount. Now, the significance of this, putting it all together, we have Yahweh that designated Moses as God to Pharaoh. You'll find that in Exodus chapter 7, verse 1. And in the same verse, God also designated Aaron as his prophet. The image that Aaron made was the golden calf, symbolic of a broken covenant with Yahweh and the worshiping of the Egyptian sun god Re that rode upon it invisibly. Now, when we take this historical understanding and place it within the symbols contained in Revelation 13, we find that the dragon, symbolic of Satan, Revelation 12, verse 9, the dragon is that old serpent, the devil, Satan. And you'll find in Isaiah chapter 14, verse 12 through 14, that it is Satan's intent to basically supersede God, to place himself in the place of God as Most High. The sea beast would also therefore have the designation as God. You'll find that in Revelation chapter 13, verse 3 and 4, when they end up worshiping the sea beast and proclaiming who is able to make war with him. If you go back and look in Exodus chapter 15, I believe it's verse 17, that's the same declaration that was made in the praise song that Miriam gave to Yahweh when he delivered them at the crossing of the Red Sea. So there's some parallels there. The land beast that would be identified as the false prophet, you'll find in Revelation chapter 19, verses 19 and 20, that it specifically refers to this beast of Revelation 13 that performs these miracles and signs and wonders to deceive people. In Revelation 19, verses 19 and 20, it specifically refers to that beast as the false prophet. And therefore, this false prophet in Revelation 13, verses 14 through 16, it makes an image which is symbolic of a broken covenant and the worshiping of the Sunday institution based on the history of the nation of Israel. Now, the significant thing, the reason that I'll back up for just a quick second, the reason that I mention that aspect of Sunday as an institution, as a Sabbath, a false Sabbath, we find that the Sabbath in the Old Testament is recorded in two different locations, the first one being in Exodus 20, verses 8 through 11. This is where God, the first time He gave the commandments to Israel, it was based upon the fact that He was the Creator. After they violated the covenant by worshiping these other gods and the golden calf, then that's when God gave them the second writing of the Ten Commandments in Deuteronomy 5, verses 12 through 15. And that is where God specifically identifies Himself and commands their worship on the Sabbath as He states that He is the Lord thy God that brought thee out thence. In other words, from the aspect of the Exodus event. So it shifts from creation to the aspect of redemption. The very issue that Israel had failed on, they worshipped these other gods, saying that these were the gods that had brought them out of Egypt. These were the gods that performed the Exodus event for them. That's the very thing that God targets in the rewriting of the fourth commandment in the second writing of the Decalogue. Now, again, exploring this just a little bit further, section 2b, no time for rest, Sabbath rest in Exodus and Revelation. According to Exodus chapter 5, verses 1, 2, and 3, I'm not going to read the whole thing, just the highlighted portions. God commanded Moses to go and speak to the Israelites to bring them out, that they may hold a feast unto me in the wilderness. Pharaoh responded by saying, "Who is the Lord? I know not the Lord, neither will I let Israel go." And therefore, they said, "The God of the Hebrews has met with us. Let us go, we pray thee, 3 days' journey into the desert and sacrifice unto the Lord our God." Now, Egypt, this was the reference I gave to you earlier in Ezekiel 29, 1 through 3. The Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, is symbolized as the great dragon that held Israel in bondage. The kind of bondage that they were involved in, of course, it was slavery, labor, forced labor, and therefore they could not observe the seventh-day Sabbath. When we go back and look in Exodus chapter 5, verses 4 and 5, the Bible says, "The king of Egypt said unto them, Wherefore do you, Moses and Aaron, let the people from their works get you unto your burdens? And Pharaoh said, Behold, the people of the land are now many, and you make them rest from their burdens." In the Hebrew, the term that is used there is Shabbath, meaning to desist from exertion, to cease, or to keep Sabbath. So that was one of the underlying issues for the nation of Israel. They could not keep the seventh-day Sabbath, being that they were in slavery and bondage in Egypt. This is the coming from Strong's Lexicon and also some other theological reference works dealing with the definition of that term, meaning to stop or to cease. I'm reading the red portion. to be still or quiet, or to have an activity no longer continue. And specifically in the green, in the hifil, in the Hebrew, it's to put an end, to stop. And that's specifically referenced in Exodus 5, verse 5. So we find that there's the underlying etymological foundation in the Hebrew for the aspect of Sabbath and rest on that day. And even in the Anchor Bible Dictionary, as early as 1996, just 11 years ago, they also identified these very same issues in doing a comparison between Exodus 20, verses 8 through 11, the Sabbath referring to creation, and Deuteronomy 5, verses 12 through 14, dealing with the Sabbath in context of the deliverance from Egyptian slavery. The key point that they mention here, I'll read down to the second green part, the soteriological and freedom from slavery emphasis in Deuteronomy 5, 14c through 15a, basically dealing with the aspect, the next green highlighted part, man is to rest on the seventh day, not only because Yahweh is the creator, rested then, but also the red highlighted portion, because Yahweh, as liberating Redeemer, sets an example of rest from slavery so that all are able to rest. It's referring to Exodus 5, verse 5. Therefore, the green portion, thus the covenant community is called upon to remember or observe both infinitive absolutes functioning as strong imperatives. The command to remember points to the origin of the Sabbath prior to Mount Sinai, an obligation going back to the beginning, and Deuteronomy uses an equivalent expression in the term observe. So both have weight, God commanding His people to observe that day, one based on the fact that He's the Creator, the second one based on the fact that He's the liberating Redeemer. Thus, the Sabbath observance in Exodus was integrally related to deliverance from slavery in Egypt. It was foundational to the covenant relationship between Yahweh and Israel. Likewise, in Revelation 12, Sabbath observance is integrally related to deliverance from slavery to sin. It is foundational to the everlasting covenant and the relationship between Yahweh and His remnant people, spiritual Israel, the SDA movement. And there's the graph showing both of those. Sabbath rest in Exodus. When they were in Egyptian slavery, they could not keep the Sabbath. Passover was deliverance from Egypt. Mount Sinai, they received the Ten Commandments and Sabbath rest. And therefore, the Sabbath was a sign of redemption for Israel. In Revelation chapter 12, those that are spiritually in bondage, they aren't converted, they don't keep the Sabbath. Calvary symbolizes deliverance from sin, and therefore the remnant keeps the commandments of God, including the Sabbath rest. And therefore, in the end of time, the Sabbath is a seal of redemption. Therefore, Revelation chapters 12 and 13, dealing with a spiritual exodus and apostasy, what we can expect then in chapter 13, as we've looked at these passages and these diagrams, is that in Revelation chapter 13, it is going to be the attempts of the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet to lead God's people away from a covenant relationship with Him based on belief in Jesus that leads to keeping of the commandments, one of those being the integral fourth commandment, the seventh-day Sabbath. So in Revelation chapter 13, the intent and the focal point of that threefold power, that counterfeit trinity, will be to lead the world and God's people out of that covenant relationship with the Lord and into the observance of a false Sabbath. Section 3, dealing with the Mount Carmel showdown in Revelation 13, we find that in 1 Kings chapter 18, Elijah, the true prophet of God, remains faithful to God during a time of national apostasy by Israel. His name denotes the central issue of the controversy. Elijah, or Yahweh, is my God. In 1 Kings 18:21, he asked the question, the central question, how long halt ye between two opinions? If Baal be God, follow him. If the Lord is God, then follow him. And Baal, therefore, is an alternate form of Beelzebub, the chief of the devils, or Satan. Those are the biblical references you can look up that will establish that. 2 Kings chapter 1, verse 3, Luke chapter 11, verse 15, Matthew chapter 9, verse 24, and Mark chapter 3, verses 22 and 23. In Revelation 12, verses 6 and 14, allusions referring to Elijah equate the remnant church of God with this true prophet of God who remained faithful to God during a time of national apostasy by Israel. Revelation 12, verse 6, it states, the woman fled into the wilderness where she hath a place prepared of God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. Verse 14, to the woman were given 2 wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place where she is nourished for a time, and times and half a time, from the face of the serpent. Now this chart basically illustrates not only the historical, but also the symbolic meaning there in Revelation 12 through 13. You'll notice that the parallel we find in the literal account is that Elijah fled to the wilderness and was cared for by God for 3.5 literal years. You'll find that in 1 Kings, the whole chapter 17, and specifically in James 5:17, it says that he had prayed that there would not be rain upon the land for 3 years and 6 months, and it didn't rain for that length of time. In Revelation 12, verses 6 and 14, the verses that I just read, is talking about this woman fleeing to the wilderness and being cared for by God for 3.5 prophetic years. Now, the logical conclusion that we come to then is that since Elijah in 1 Kings 17 was designated by God as the true prophet during a time of national apostasy, in chapter 18, Elijah calls fire down from heaven, symbolizing that he's serving the true God. What we would expect in this unfolding of events, spiritually speaking, in the end of time during the eschaton, is that we find the remnant church being equated with the true prophet, and therefore some kind of a conflict or confrontation taking place between this true church, the true prophet in the end time, and those that are false prophets. Now, the interesting thing, what we find in Revelation 13, is that it is not the remnant church, the true prophet, that performs this miracle of calling fire down from heaven, as God did back in 1 Kings chapter 18. Instead, it is the false prophet, the second beast, that calls fire down from heaven. In Revelation chapter 13, we find that there are times when there's the activity of the threefold false trinity is to counterfeit the work of God, and at other times, when God's people have been faithful, it is actually to duplicate the means that Satan used in the Old Testament to try to deceive them. So there's kind of an interplay between those two activities of the false trinity in Revelation 13. Thus understood, Revelation 12, verses 6 and 14 contains symbolic allusions to Elijah, the true prophet of God, who remained faithful to God during a time of national apostasy by Israel. Based on this symbolism, the remnant church of God is equated with Elijah and may therefore be identified as the true prophet of God. In Revelation 13, the remnant church of God, the true prophet, is called upon to confront the apostasy of those religions that have departed from the commandments of God and that do not enjoy a covenant relationship with Yahweh. Section 4, dealing with the golden image and the fiery furnace. The events of Daniel 3 occur in 593 BC and record the faithful allegiance of 3 Hebrew youth. Nebuchadnezzar's primary motivation in building the golden statue was due to an issue of political allegiance. In the same year and prior to the building of the statue, there had been a revolt in his empire. The way in which he determined the allegiance of his appointed rulers was to test their fidelity to his reign by worshiping the golden statue. The significance of the image from Daniel 3 compared to Revelation 13 is that just as in Daniel 3, there was a political uprising that had just occurred in Babylon that led to the building of this image and the enforced worship, so also Revelation 13.1 on the screen on your right, politics and religion will play pivotal roles in the end time, the interaction of those two. And also the state will establish a test of fealty or allegiance based on religious practices, and this test will conflict with God's commands. Putting this in a graph form, spiritual Israel and the spiritual Exodus, we've already established prior to this, relating to historical literal Israel and the Exodus. Ellen White warns us against worldly customs which lead to idolatry, and she says that as we adopt those and practice those, we're preparing ourselves to receive the mark of the beast in the end of time. During this historical period of the nation of Israel, they had periods of prosperity and also decline. They were involved in idolatry. You read throughout the books of 1 and 2 Kings, and rarely was there a king that, in fact, I don't recall one, except possibly Josiah, that actually rooted out and eradicated all forms of idolatry, including the worship on the high places. Each king, either he violated God's covenant and walked in the ways after the heathen nations, or if he was faithful to God, the Bible says that except in the fact that he did not eradicate the high places. So they were very much, they had interwoven in their history that aspect of idolatry. Leading up to the Babylonian captivity and the image at Dura in Daniel 3, it was not until, or in the historical context of the establishment of Israel, the captivity of Israel in Babylon, that that occurred. Therefore, in this historical spiritual progression, it's not until the formation of Babylon in the end of time that God's people will be faced with this final test. In those verses that are displayed on the screen, it establishes that Babylon is the great city composed of the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. Now, a tabular overview of what we've looked at, and this is kind of leading up to our summary here. We've got the date, the event, the issue, who was involved, the consequences, the historical context, and I left the last column, the symbolism, blank, because on the third table we'll look at that. Basically, these are just the time periods in which these events occurred. Creation, the issue was Sabbath as a memorial of God as the Creator, the Trinity, the Godhead created man. The consequence was that man would worship his Creator. Therefore, the issue, the point in question in blue there, is that who is the Creator? In the Exodus event and the Mount Sinai idolatry, the issues involved were the law, the covenant, the Ten Commandments, and the worship of the golden calf. The individuals involved, Yahweh, Moses, Aaron, and Israel. The consequences of that led to judgment, a broken covenant, and names that were blotted out of the book of life. If you look in Exodus 32, Moses interceded for Israel and even asked God to take his own name out of the book. A book of life, but God said no, those that had sinned would be the ones that would be punished. The historical context, Pharaoh had asked the central question, who is Yahweh? He did not know or did not acknowledge Yahweh. In the Mount Carmel experience in 1 Kings chapter 18, the issue was again involving covenant and worship. Those involved were Yahweh, Elijah, Ahab, and Israel. The consequences is that the covenant was renewed for Israel and the rain began to fall. Symbolic, perhaps, of the latter rain in the context of Revelation 13. The historical context of that, though, is that who is the true God? It was a question between Baal or Yahweh that Elijah had raised imposed to the nation of Israel. In Daniel 3, the golden image, at that event, the issue was political allegiance. The individuals involved, Nebuchadnezzar, the three Hebrew youth, and the image. The consequences, their faith was tested. They were persecuted for it, and God showed himself as their deliverer. Therefore, the historical context, it involved Yahweh versus the gods of Babylon, which were Bel and Nebo. And the question was, who can deliver after this sort? If you read in Daniel chapter 3, verse 15, that was the very question that Nebuchadnezzar had posed to those three Hebrew youth. Now, putting that in the context of Revelation 12 and 13, we have the time period being the eschaton, the event being those things that I've mentioned, Genesis, Sinai, Mount Carmel, the image, the issues, the covenant, the law, Sabbath, the individuals involved, spiritual Israel, the Seventh-day Adventist movement, and the counterfeit Trinity plus the image. The consequences of it being either eternal salvation or eternal loss. Future context, the questions that were raised in the Old Testament historical settings, who is the Creator? Who is Yahweh? Who is the true God? Who is the Deliverer? The answer to that will find its resolution in this end time conflict, controversy. Yahweh is the one who answers those questions. The false or counterfeit Trinity attempts to answer those, and they don't. They don't meet the criteria. In summary, the Sabbath truth is alluded to in Revelation 13 through various biblical images. Number one, by describing the second beast as giving breath to the image, allusion is made to the act of man being created and the Sabbath being made for man. Number two, through forceful imagery reminiscent of the Exodus and the consequent idolatry of Israel at Mount Sinai, strong warning is given to God's remnant church in the end time to avoid apostasy from the Lord and His covenant, which includes Sabbath observance. Number three, by means of subtle nuances in time units, Revelation 12 equates the remnant church with the prophet Elijah, as he stood faithfully on the Lord's side on Mount Carmel in opposition to the false prophets of Baal, so the remnant church must confront the false prophet of Revelation 13. At issue will be the renewal of a covenant relationship between the Lord and his remnant church that includes Sabbath observance. And number four, as the three Hebrew youth remained faithful in the worship of the true God when faced with the threat of worshiping the golden image, so God's people will maintain their fidelity to Him. The issue will be proper worship of the Lord, clothed in the garments of political devising. Thank you.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright 2007, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 1-800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. There you will discover the largest selection of genuine Adventist preaching available. American Cassette Ministries is not a one-man band. It's an orchestra of outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Cassette Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.